and welcome to the Library Cafe on WVKR. I'm Thomas Hill. Our guest today is David Weinberger, author, lecturer, and fellow at Harvard University's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society. He holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of Toronto and taught philosophy for 6 years. David is the author of the book Small Pieces Loosely Joined and co-author of the bestseller The Clue Train Manifesto. He is also a frequent contributor to NPR's All Things Considered, is a technology commentator in a variety of print and digital media, and not an item to be overlooked on anyone's resume, he was a comedy writer for Woody Allen for 7 years. David is one of a very small handful of people circulating in the traditional mainstream media who is not only able to talk without hype or hysteria about the World Wide Web, but who is able to place internet culture in its intellectual context with respect to the history of knowledge and information technologies, including the history of books and printing and the history of libraries. He is talking with us today by telephone about his latest book, Everything is Miscellaneous, The Power of the New Digital Disorder, published by Times Books. Hello, David.
Hello.
I thought I might start out by telling you how I came across your book, and it was not by culling through alphabetical lists of new library acquisitions, nor by searching in the library catalog or WorldCat under the appropriate subject headings, nor by searching books in print online under those same subject headings, nor by any of the means that we librarians have constructed to find information, but instead it jumped out at me as I opened up my Amazon account one day because it was similar in some respects to books I had previously purchased or looked at. And presumably the system included in its algorithms my past search behavior, but also I expect the search behavior and purchases other people had made who looked at these same items. And I have to say I find Amazon's system fascinating as a librarian because of this serendipity factor. Librarians often hear from people who use libraries how important the ability to browse is in the research process. And losing this serendipity was one of the fears, mostly justified, I think, of moving from catalog cards to digital library catalogs, and that digital catalogs really don't do this very well in the way they're configured at the moment anyway. And the value of OpenStax is especially cited here also.
Well, OpenStax, which are fine, are actually an incredibly limited way of organizing information. It makes a single decision about what book should be next to what books, and no matter how good that decision is, and libraries obviously are good at making that decision, nevertheless, it limits the ways books are connected to a single order, a single way. That's how atoms work. You got to pick one way of organizing. And so while we all like browsing the OpenStax, and many of us have romantic feelings about, or romanticized feelings anyway, about browsing the OpenStax, it's really a terrible constriction. It throws out all sorts of information, all sorts of ways in which books are actually linked. Yeah. It looks neat and tidy, and we like the serendipity of there, but it's not. It's highly organized and extremely limited serendipity. If somebody came along and currently said, you know what we should do with all of our electronic information, all the, now that we're browsing things electronically, we should set up a single way that's the same for everybody that clusters books by topic. Wouldn't that be a great way to browse? People would, you know, roll their eyes and be shocked at the very notion, and yet that's what we've put up with in the real world because we've had to for thousands of years. And while we've romanticized it, it's in fact a terrible, terrible limitation.
Yeah. But there is a serendipity factor now in Amazon, isn't there?
But sure, there's serendipity. Serendipity is not a problem in the electronic world.
Yeah.
It's the opposite. So Amazon, I think, is fantastic at finding ways to relate books. You know, organizing is whatever it is, whether it's books or silverware or your clothing, is a matter of picking a way things are alike, some mm-hmm. sort of vector, some characteristic or attribute that they have in common, and saying that's the important one. And so we cluster by finding these likenesses. But things have lots and lots of different attributes, lots of ways in which they're alike. And having to pick one, which might be, for example, the main topic of the book, you know, not all books have a main topic, but that's very useful. Amazon does that. It has its own classification scheme, very similar to the ones that libraries use. But that's at the bottom of the page because, in fact, most people don't want to browse that way. And instead, Amazon finds these other ways, these other sorts of likenesses, some of which are just odd. They have statistically improbable phrases, or SIPs, right? They use some algorithm to find phrases in a book that are unlikely, but seem to have some significance. So it might be Harpoon Boat in Moby Dick.
Mm-hmm.
And then they use that. You can click on one of those SIPs to find other books that use the same phrase. Now, that frequently turns out to be a pretty weird way of clustering books, but why not? You can include as many different ways as you want just about on your page. So Amazon has dozens and dozens of ways of pulling books together. And some of them are very useful, some are just sort of weird. But put together, all these different ways of browsing are far more useful than OpenStax can be.
Yeah, sure. I suppose the reason so many people, from a librarian's perspective, you do hear this, wax nostalgic about the stacks, or talk about the stacks and the serendipity factor, is that the other tools that we construct for people to do research are so limiting that the little bit of serendipity that you get then in being able to browse the stacks, you know, opens up the notion of chance in research, and that's something highly valued. If you don't want to end up just knowing what you already know, in a sense, or just know what you're looking for and not...
Yeah, and obviously it's not simply chance.
Yeah.
It's some form of structure.
Yeah, sure.
So it's some vector or some attribute that things have in common that you hadn't thought about.
Yeah, it's a bit like a department store, isn't it, where the shoes are together, at least the way department stores used to be, and the men's furnishings together, and et cetera, et cetera.
Sure, and you know, you're browsing for men's clothing, and that makes sense, but it's not, again, if you were doing an online catalog, to insist that there be a single way that people browse would simply drive people from your catalog.
Sure. I wonder, with my experience with Second Life, if you couldn't go one better than Amazon, or sort of combine Amazon with stack-type browsing and construct a universal library where you can virtually walk through and browse titles as you do in physical stacks, but change the arrangement according to various criteria that you might put in. So, you know, you could change the category so that if a book fell under more than one category and you were looking just for material on that category, you could find all the books on that category in one place. I don't know. There's just something about the physicality, I suppose, of the roaming process that...
Well, I think we'll lose that. There have been various attempts to display the results of this sort of sorting as a set of book spines.
Yeah, yeah.
But it turns out...
People don't like it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a sort of... You say that's cute, and then you realize you're reading sideways, and it's not giving you as much information as you'd like. And,
sure.
You move on.
Yeah, interesting.
Actually, we do have a way of... You know, every tag is, in fact, a bookshelf.
Uh-huh.
So you can do... This doesn't get to your idea of the physical display, but when users tag objects, books or pages or whatever, photographs, with a word or a label that makes sense to them so that they can go back and find it again, and when lots of people are doing that and all the tags that other people are using are made available to everyone, when it's a public tagging system, frequently is at, for example, Amazon, but also at photo sites like Flickr and the rest.
Yeah.
Or Library Thing, which is a site where people share not their books, but the information about their books, you know, their reading list, so to speak.
You can make a virtual bookshelf there quite nicely, actually.
In fact, every tag is exactly that. So if you clicked on the tag whaling, and stick with the Moby Dick for the moment, which might be used to tag Moby Dick, it will create a list, but in effect a bookshelf, of all books that anybody has tagged whaling. And the next moment you click 19th century and you got yourself a different bookshelf that might include some of the whaling books, of course. So every tag is a bookshelf.
Yeah, interesting. You dedicate your book to the librarians, but organizing things isn't limited to librarians, of course. And I found your discussion in the book about putting away the groceries or the silverware a kind of revelation in this regard, because organizing things is so common a human behavior that we don't really think about it, do we? Nor do we realize just how ubiquitous this behavior is in our lives.
No, I mean, we think about it when we have large collections of similar objects, and there's no standard or obviously right organizational scheme. So we think about it when we're organizing, we're moving into a house and we're organizing our clothing for the first time, or our books, or, you know, CDs.
Yeah.
And so we think about it there. And we frequently realize just how arbitrary and unsatisfying any particular way of organizing is. But put those exceptions aside, and our entire houses are organized one way or another.
Yeah.
So we are constantly putting things together that are alike in some useful way.
Yeah.
So what's on your desk? You know, that's a collection of stuff that is very, very different in most respects, except that it has something in common. That's why you put it on your desk. And what it has in common may be as simple as things you use when you're working. But that turns out to be the most important organizing principle, the likeness that matters the most for things, you know, for organizing your desk. And with on your desk, you undoubtedly even in a case like my desk, which is a horrible mess, nevertheless, I know that I put things I'm supposed to be reading but I'm going to forget to, and they'll pile up for years. That's the left-hand pile.
Yeah.
Pile of pens on the right, et cetera. And it's rather complexly organized, even though it's, in my case, hugely messily organized. And so we do this all the time. We're constantly finding the ways that things are alike and physically arranging them to meet the various sorts of needs that we have, which include utilitarian but also aesthetic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very, very basic way of relating to reality, isn't it? And of cognition, really, isn't it? Matching and sorting.
Absolutely. I mean, there is no language without doing this.
Yeah.
You know, at the most basic level of us being able to talk with one another or see the world as consisting not of this thing, which is essentially apart from that thing, but rather seeing that those two things are both, for example, trees or animals. That requires the most basic act of organizing, which is to see two things as sharing an attribute.
So your book is about the way we organize knowledge on the whole and how conventional systems of classification that we traditionally used are giving way through a kind of paradigm shift in the way we understand and practice organizing things. And you actually organize or classify these systems yourself into three orders. And I wonder if you could talk about those.
Yeah. So the first two orders are traditional. In the first order, you organize the things themselves. You put the socks into the sock drawer and the shirts on hangers in your closet, or you organize the books on the shelves and the photos in the album. And the second, you do this thing that we learned to do pretty early on, which is to physically separate the information about that stuff from the stuff. Now, the information about information is called metadata, so you physically separate the metadata from the data. In the case of a library, which is a really clear example, especially a library 20 years ago, before this digitalization thing happened, you make library cards, you make catalog cards, and you figure out what is the useful information to put on a 3x5 card so that you can find the book again. And we've gotten very good at doing that. It's a science to doing it well, and you get advantages from doing this. It's far easier to walk through the card catalog than it is to walk through the, I think it's 520 miles of shelves at the Library of Congress.
Yeah.
Plus, because you've reduced the amount of information to what fits on a 3x5 card, you actually have room to provide 2, 3, 4 different ways of organizing. So in the first order, you only get one way of organizing, because that's how atoms work. In the second order, you get 3 or 4. Maybe more. You get subject author title, typically, in an old library card catalog. And that's very handy also. But we pay a price for doing this. In order to get the benefits, we have to reduce the information to what fits on a 3x5 card,
yes,
which is, in effect, an enormous throwing away of information. Everything in the book that doesn't fit on the 3x5 card is simply ignored for purposes of the metadata, for how we're going to be able to find the book. That's an enormous waste of information. It's required in the first and second orders, but in the third order, everything is digital. The content gets scanned in and is digital, and the metadata also is digital.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that the old principles that we've used for organizing our stuff in the first and second order, most of those principles simply don't apply anymore, and we have to invent new ones.
So does this mean the fact that when we classify things, ordinarily when we think of classification, we do it to forget as well as to remember? There are things we just don't want to have to attend to so that we can identify an item and think about how it relates to other things. In the third order, is this forgetting then unnecessary? We don't really have to forget anything about the item? We can classify it and still remember everything that there is to remember about it? Or is there still some kind of selection going on in the naming processes?
The problem in the first and second orders is that we have to forget, not because it's good to forget, but because that's what's required if we're going to be able to focus our attention.
Right.
Again, there's no problem with that. We do have to be able to focus our attention in order to be able to navigate and to make sense of our world. The issue in the first and second order is that we have to make a single decision about that. So we have to decide that we're going to organize our CDs, or in the case of a library, it could be thousands and thousands and thousands of CDs or millions of books. We have to decide that the way to organize them on the shelves is alphabetically or chronologically or by genre or whatever. And any one of those might be the right way to do it. But the problem is we have to pick just one. Digitally, we're still going to always, I think, always look through things using a very limited number of attributes. That is, we're going to do a search query or organize dynamically by date and then by genre and then alphabetically by who is playing the trombone. Mm-hmm. But we can make that decision now and in another second, or another person simultaneously can say, no, I have a different task. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to find early American trombonists or whatever. She says, I'm really interested in CDs that were originally released in German in the 1960s and that have a backbeat. Mm-hmm. And so that's how she organizes. And she can do it her way, I can do it my way, we can do it simultaneously. We don't have to make a single decision about it. Mm-hmm. And that's really what the...
It's a big step forward.
That's the big step. It's not that, despite the title of my book, it's not really that there's a big pile of miscellaneous stuff and now we can't find anything.
Yeah.
The real step forward is this is a big miscellaneous pile until the moment somebody says, here's how I want to find something, here's how I want to make sense of it, and instantly it's no longer miscellaneous, and that's really the crucial bit.
With respect to organizational systems, you know, certainly the alphabet comes to mind, and you give a fascinating account of the history of alphabetizing early on in the book and what might be termed the dream of the universal alphabet. And interestingly, the use of the alphabet as a means of organizing knowledge, say by Diderot and the great encyclopedists of the modern era, is regarded by some people, like Coleridge, as subversive.
And by some of the clerics of the time as well, because they saw it as a denuding of meaning. The clerics thought that the encyclopedia was a representation of knowledge, and thus of the world, and to present it in mere alphabetical order, which they recognized was arbitrary, was to sever the real relationships among the pieces. Mm-hmm. They would rather have the encyclopedia present an organization that connected pieces more synthetically. So that, yeah, they saw it as taking this grand structure of the universe, which is the crown of God's creation, and trashing it, saying, it doesn't count for anything, we'll make it all alphabetical. And to some degree, Coleridge had a similar sort of complaint, and it's a complaint that has continued, not so much these days as a slap in the face of God, but simply as a failure to note the important relationships that are there.
Yeah, you talk about Mortimer Adler, who in the 20th century picked up the torch on this.
Here is a philosopher, a hugely brilliant man, who's, in some ways, I think it's fair to say, given the big projects that he engaged in, that his life was devoted to trying to make public the connections among the big ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did this. He was on the board of the Encyclopedia Britannica, and for years and years and years pushed to have, in addition to the alphabetical ordering, a way of ordering the pieces that would show the relationships.
Mm-hmm. And he did this, didn't he, with the Macropedia, essentially, is that product of Adler's work, eventual product?
Yes, but also the, I'm going to forget
was
the name of it.
Propedia, was it?
Yes. So the Macropedia provides longer form articles on fewer topics.
Yeah.
So, for example, when you put together the cluster of philosophy articles in the Macropedia of the Britannica, it's something like 180,000 words,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, a typical book is about 60,000 words. So it's three books worth of stuff. Adler was particularly interested in doing the sort of indexing that would cluster ideas by their relationship, not simply by their alphabetical order. And I mean, there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing that. I mean, it would be, I think, crazy to say, no, Adler should not have done that.
No.
Why not? He's adding to... But he wasn't doing exactly what he thought, or I think he failed to recognize the limitations of what he thought he was doing. He thought he was finding what are more or less objective or real relationships among the pieces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is he then essentially a student of Aristotle here, in a sense?
Only in the way that I think we all are students of Aristotle.
Yeah.
So he had this very high-minded notion that there is a way, and it would be foolish to deny, you would think, that there is a real connection among the big topics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's arguable that there are connections among the big topics, and there's nothing wrong with surfacing those.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is thinking that there is one set of connections.
Yes.
And I think that in the case of Adler, failing to recognize just how... Well, let's say, to use a loaded word, how privileged his point of view was.
Mm-hmm.
The world looks different and can look radically different to different people.
Yeah.
There is some truth in the postmodern view. This is not a pure relativism, but there is nevertheless some truth that the canon of who we think are the big thinkers. Adler was the creator of the Great Book series.
Mm-hmm.
And the canon of what we think are the big ideas in our culture, this canon does not come to us neutrally. It does come from a particular tradition, way of thought, and very likely is influenced by the power and authority of those. So nothing wrong with laying out here's how I think the ideas are connected. Saying that this is the way is probably wrong and not helpful, the opposite of helpful. Finding ways in which lots of ideas can be connected in lots of different ways and lots of people can participate additively makes the world smarter and wiser. But that way, we now know, it's called linking.
Yeah.
This is the big step forward that we took in not just in digitizing things, but in the creation of the World Wide Web in particular,
mm-hmm.
is to make linking easy and highly valuable.
Yeah, but linking isn't static, and it's certainly not hierarchical, really, is it?
No. I mean, you can make, obviously, you could make hierarchy, and you could keep static links, but no, overall, linking tends to be highly dynamic and incredibly messy. But this is another part of the reaction against, or the move away from, what we could call an Aristotelian tradition, or actually a Greek tradition, of order, in which we assumed that order had to be not only singular, you know, one way that the world is ordered, but that that way has to be, you know, the Greeks had the same word for order and for beauty, that the order has to be clear and simple and elegant and crystalline and beautiful.
It's a question that this discussion incorporates, the question of the extent to which what we claim to know is socially constructed.
I want to be a little careful about the social construction term, since it has some implied meaning.
Connotations,
The part of it that is true, I think, is that there isn't a single way that the world presents itself to us, much less a single way that we can identify and that has the authority that we thought objectivity has.
Yeah.
It certainly is the case that the world shows itself to us depending upon how we approach it, what our language enables us to see of the world, and based upon our position and our interests. The part of the social construction thing that I want to stay away from is that it is sometimes taken to mean that we are free to socially construct the world any way we want. All ways are equally valid. There is no possibility of radical error. And it seems to me just sort of commonsensical, which is usually a phrase that means I'm wrong and I can't argue for it, but I'll leave that as it is. It seems to be commonsensical to believe that, well, no, not all ways of taking the world are right. There is a way that the world is, but it is possible to go wrong, but there are many, many, many ways to take the world, and how we take the world is always at least due in part, well, to two things. One is our interests, what we're trying to accomplish, what matters to us. And second of all, our culture, our social, you know, that's the social part of social construction.
For medievalists, my background is medieval literature, that there are echoes here of the debate between realists and nominalists that took place in the 14th century.
Well, it is a perpetual argument, though. It is similar, but I think it's also different. One of the perpetual arguments, because the argument is over how much our involvement in understanding the world matters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to imagine we will ever get past that discussion. It is the central discussion. How much of our involvement affects what we know? So I don't think that what I've been saying is, it's certainly closer to nominalism than to realism.
Yeah.
But it lacks the sense that the world is simply how we name it. I think I'm being commonsensical here, but it seems to me that the situation is as follows. We live in a very complex world in which there are many different attributes of things. You look at stuff circling our sun, and there are attributes like shape, heat, color. I don't know if the list is endless, but in terms of practice, it's an endless list of different things we could say about the object circling our sun. Every one of those attributes can serve as a likeness by which we cluster our world. So we can find all the objects that are hot, all the objects that have water, all the objects that are round, etc. Ad infinitum, just about. Each of those ways of clustering, each of those attributes, each of those likenesses, is a way we can cluster and categorize. We're not free to do it any way that we want. We can be wrong in how we cluster things. We can say that Pluto has water when in fact it doesn't. We certainly can be wrong. So it's not a pure nominalism, but the possible ways of clustering is huge, and the choices that we make are dictated not by the world itself, but rather by what we're interested in. There isn't a single order of the universe that the wise person tries to understand and present to everybody else. That's more or less Adler's view, right? Here that he's wise, and he was wise, I think. And here's how I see justice and economics connected.
Yeah.
So the difference between thinking that there's a single way that a wise person would present and understand the universe to saying, oh, there are many ways of understanding the universe.
Yeah.
It really depends upon your interests at the moment, and each of those ways is true.
You make the point, and this is central to your book, that reality is multifaceted and that how we divide it up is contingent on why we divide it up. And this is a point that other recent guests on the program have made quite often, actually. Last week we were talking with K. David Harrison, a linguist who works with dying languages, about just this, that one of the reasons that it's so important to preserve linguistic diversity on the planet is that other language systems almost always lump and split nature in radically different ways than we do. And the knowledge that we could learn about the world from these dying and pretty much ignored languages makes our present dream of the universal archive seem rather self-absorbed. And to use a metaphor from your book, we're like one of these seven blind men with the elephant in this. And the point is that, you know, if we don't leave ourselves open to classifying the world in new ways, we're only going to be able to know essentially what we already know. And Jeffrey Bowker, an historian of science we spoke with last month, made exactly this point also. So are there ways that the third order organizational systems can help us in organizing the vast amounts of data that we're collecting, especially recently? I mean, we're digitizing everything in huge quantities and not quite sure what we're going to do with all this data. Or is a bigger, better controlled vocabulary the only way to go here?
Oh, well, certainly not the controlled vocabulary. It is not the only. Sometimes controlled vocabularies are extraordinarily useful, and so I don't want to say never, they're always evil. Quite the contrary, this is all edited, so every way we have of sorting and order, including controlled vocabularies and Mortimer Adler's way of organizing, all that's useful, but highly constrained. So there are times when you want to control vocabulary, especially when you have an interest, or your patrons have an interest, in finding everything related to a topic.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing a law library or corporate research, maybe you want to have a controlled vocabulary. That's very useful, but you pay a price for it. One is that you sometimes need specialists to do the cataloging. Mm-hmm. Not always, but, and specialists doing cataloging just doesn't scale very well. As the system gets very big, it becomes way too expensive.
Exactly. That's the problem. You have these, people from all disciplines building these databases of ecosystems that stretch across eons of time now, and they're trying to put in everything they know, astronomical information, botanical information, geological information.
Yeah, and so leaving that in the hands of experts who are the ones qualified to do it, it doesn't work. You can't get up to the numbers that you want. There are other problems with controlled vocabularies, which are the ones you were just pointing to, namely that while they enable people to find everything on a topic, because when they're searching for beach photos, they're not saying, oh, I'll type in shore.
Mm-hmm.
They know what the vocabulary is, and so they'll get all of them. The vocabulary is created within some cultural community, and that means, it's always going to be more limited. There are always going to be edge cases where people can't catalog things and can't find things the way that they want to because that community doesn't think about things that way. You think about what the controlled vocabulary might be for a photo of kids playing on a beach.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're competent humans, we'll come up with a reasonable controlled vocabulary. But to another culture, it might not actually be a photo of kids and beach or play. It may be something that, we can't think of because it's not within our culture.
Yeah.
And so controlled vocabularies work exactly by limiting what we are willing to know about a particular object. There's advantages to that, but there's also a price.
Yeah. So tagging by users might be the best way to go here.
It provides another set of information.
Yeah.
Tagging systems don't work very well when it's important for people to find all of the object, because people will just tag things in unpredictable ways and sometimes purely idiosyncratic ways.
Yeah. But the rule is, with these large databases, sometimes I wonder if you need to find every item. Once you get a certain threshold, maybe just finding mostly what you're looking for, because there's so much there, is enough.
Absolutely. So if you are trying to find, you're thinking about,
I'm thinking of the way, say, traditionally, if we were looking for images of Chartres Cathedral or some unusual corner of Chartres Cathedral, I'd go into a subject catalog of some kind, maybe the Marburger Index, and try to track it down. Now I can go onto Flickr and almost invariably find it, even though there may be many photos on the web that I'm missing of what I'm looking for. There are enough on there that I can actually find some usable photos.
Depending on what you're trying to do.
Absolutely.
If you're thinking about going to Shark, then, and you just want to, you know, get a sense of what it's like, then you don't need to find all 7 million photos that people have taken and posted
no.
to Flickr, or
no.
100,000, whatever
no.
it is.
No. No, and even if you want an image of a certain odd gargoyle, you're likely to find it. If a tourist could get at it with a camera,
you might, but you may have to look through lots of photos.
Yeah.
People probably aren't tagging the gargoyles in a way that would make them findable.
Yeah, that's
again.
True.
And
yeah.
you will miss. Then your point is, it doesn't matter that you'll miss these, but you will miss the photos of Chartres that people tagged as church instead of cathedral,
yeah.
and where they misspelled Chartres, which
yeah.
I'm guessing some high percentage do.
Yeah.
For tourism, that's fine. If you were doing something more systematic, if you're a lawyer or you're doing scholarly
yeah,
research,
yeah.
it might be...
No, you don't want to miss a case, I suppose.
So
how momentous is the arrival of the Third Order? Does it have historical precedence, or is this something entirely new under the sun?
Well, sure, it has historical precedence, because, you know, everything does.
Yeah. You mentioned Ranganathan in the book and his faceted system. Is that something at least leading up to a Third Order system?
Well, it turns out that his system, which he devised in the 30s, becomes really useful in a digital world.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, it's sort of a best of both worlds system. Also, the limitations of both worlds
yeah.
system. But it was a system in reaction to the Dewey Decimal System, actually. He was an Indian librarian, a coiner of the term library science. And he was reacting against Dewey. He wanted something that was more homegrown and responsive to Indian
mm-hmm.
needs. So it's a system that is open-ended rather than having an expert-decided, you know, thousand-slot system. It's more open-ended, and it turns out that with the use of computers, it allows you to browse a hierarchy, a taxonomy, which is a very useful way of browsing. Humans seem to be maybe even wired to browse this way, but to do so without having to do it in the order that the creator of the taxonomy assumed you'd want.
Mm-hmm.
So these are now called faceted classification systems. They're showing up all over the web at sites that have either retail sites with lots and lots of things to sell
mm-hmm.
or media sites that have lots of topics.
Yeah, interesting.
So in a faceted system, the user can say, in the case of a library search, that right now she wants to browse first by year to see 19th century books, and then books by women, and then fiction versus nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one type of branching structure. And at the next instant, be able to say, no, for right now I'd like to see books by genre, and then by country, and then by year, or whatever. So it gives the benefits of taxonomic hierarchical searching without the drawback of having to use somebody else's idea of what the root is. So this stuff always has precedence. The tagging is, it's like stickies, putting stickies on things or whatever.
Yeah.
But the differences, I think, are significant, and not simply because the world has gotten easier to browse and to find things, though that certainly
yeah.
counts. I think rather what's at stake, I'll go back to Aristotle, which you brought him up.
Yeah.
We've had an Aristotelian view of the order of the world itself. We've,
mm-hmm.
we've thought that there is a way that the world is, and the wise person can figure out what that order is, and the order is neat, and everything goes in one place. That's the essence of it. That whether it's an Aristotelian tree of order or any other sort, doesn't matter. We've assumed for millennia in the West that the right order, the revelatory order of the universe, the way the world is,
mm-hmm.
is that everything has a single place. So that, what's that thing over there? It's a bird. It's a robin.
Mm-hmm.
What's a robin? It's a type of bird. What's
mm-hmm.
a bird? It's a type of animal, and so forth. It has a single place in our order, which turns out to be how the physical world works. That's how we organize the things in our world. But it's a terrible limitation to put on our ideas. The
yeah.
fact that ideas have to be ordered that way as well. We're losing that notion that there is a single way, and we're losing also the notion that a thing is its single place in the world. And, finally, and in some ways I think the most important, we have institutions that have authority because we've assumed they have privileged access to how the single order is. Those institutions are beginning to lose that authority.
Yeah. So what happens to the idea of authority and truth in a third order system? And I'm thinking here now about discussions about Wikipedia that seem to be everywhere. Wherever you look anymore, people are talking about this.
So truth, I think, goes from the notion, and this is, you'll recognize this is not new only in the past 10 years with the rise of the web. This is a movement we've been going through.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
That the web sort of makes real. So it goes from thinking that the truth is the single way things are to a very small but important modification, which is to say truth is the way things show themselves depending upon our interest, what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
Things can still be wrong. You can classify Pluto as one of the objects that in the solar system that has water, and you will be either right or wrong. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm not sure which.
So truth is context-dependent?
What shows itself to us, what we care about, depends upon what we're trying to do. It was totally commonsensical.
Yeah.
But now, rather than thinking there's a single way the world is, that is the truth, and it... No, it's the world is lots of ways. Yeah. More ways than we can count. And now we can find the world. We make those connections so easily.
Does this fit into a phenomenological worldview quite nicely?
Yeah. You heard me saying the way the world shows itself to us, and you made the proper assumption that, in fact, I'm a closet phenomenologist.
Okay. It does seem to work.
So in terms of authority, it becomes much harder, because we've had this magical, what I think is a magical belief, a very comforting belief, that there are a set of people called authorities who we can consult and simply believe. And that's very efficient, and usually we're right doing it. You know, your Encyclopedia Britannica usually is right. But, frankly, it's a childish belief. It's a, you know, it's superstition.
Yeah, yeah.
And Britannica is usually right because it has a very precise, careful process that keeps it very limited. It can manage 65,000 articles.
Yeah, but you must have known people that could skip through the Britannica or Webster's Dictionary and find one howler after the next also. I mean, some people have always kind of questioned the authority of kind of standard reference works.
As they should.
Yeah.
I mean, even within the very limited field that they can manage, it's 65,000 topics. Wikipedia has 2 million over the course of like 5 years, which is way less than it takes even to do a revision of the print Britannica. Wikipedia has 2 million in the English alone.
Yeah.
So 65,000 is fine, but it means it spends a lot more time on the Peloponnesian War than it does on some other stuff that probably matters to us. And even that process, and this is, Britannica has had a vested interest. I don't mean to pick on them, they're just, you know, completely typical.
Yeah.
They've had a vested interest in maintaining the appearance of basically infallibility.
Yeah.
You know, they are the authorities. We believe it because it comes from Britannica.
Yeah.
And now, with Wikipedia, which I love, by the way, Wikipedia has discussion pages for every article where you see the sausage being made.
Yeah, it has its own built-in self-critiquing mechanisms, doesn't it? Or critiquing mechanisms.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely,
self-critiquing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It has complex mechanisms for trying to get to a reasonable approximation of the truth.
Yeah.
And in the discussion pages, you can see exactly what you cannot see, that what Britannica and the New York Times and every other authority desperately wants to hide from us, which is this clash of unknowing as people try to figure out what's true, what's worth saying.
Yeah, interesting. Well, what happens to the identity of the knower in this? You know, because so many of the articles, say, in Wikipedia are anonymous and pseudonymous, but, you know, I sometimes wonder reading it, if it doesn't encourage a kind of civic virtue and develop of a personal integrity, at least in the possibility for a development of a kind of ethic for people who are writing for it.
I think you're absolutely right. I think it's one of the unsung virtues of Wikipedia is that, you know, the Wikipedians are in some ways, that is, the people who are most committed to it and spend an enormous amount of time, they're in some ways an odd lot.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, they insist on two things in their discussions, on the discussion pages where these issues are thrashed out. One is that we drive towards neutrality in what we say. That's always the highest value. Is it neutral to say this? And second is, say it civilly. We can't make any progress if you're going to just yell and scream, please back up what you're saying with facts or citations. They're usually quite calm about it in the face of sometimes hysterical commentators. They insist on neutrality and they insist on civility.
Mm-hmm.
We should be very happy about that as a culture.
Yeah, and without real editors controlling everything, without that top-down control, it seems to me people have to kind of learn to edit themselves.
You know,
take
you can read in the discussion pages, somebody comes in and she's sort of loaded for bear. She is so angry that anybody might say this, and the people who wrote this article are such idiots, and I can't believe it. And in a successful discussion page back and forth, you will see this person drop the anger and the name-calling and engage.
Yeah.
In a way that would make Aristotle proud.
Yeah. On the other hand, apart from getting a kind of neutral view and presumably some kind of objectivity in that respect, you also get then the value of eccentricities and the rhetorical side of things, I suppose, apart from the philosophical side of things, all in one package.
You do. And you also get a hidden homogeneity,
yeah.
which is, I wish, was more widely recognized.
Yeah.
So if you go to the aviation history of aviation in the English language version and the French version,
mm-hmm.
so we're not talking here about a jihadist version of the Bush article. I mean, this is, you know, aviation history.
Yeah.
They're very different in who they think the relative contributions of the pioneers, in particular the French and the English one.
Oh, yeah. Histories of technology tend to be very nationalistic, don't they? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it would be good for readers of Wikipedia, in order to keep Wikipedia from settling into a new type of authority, it would be good if readers recognize that the various language versions of Wikipedia are good faith attempts to achieve neutrality, but always fail, because we're culturally biased is the wrong word, but, we are.
It would be interesting to go, now it occurs to me, to look at the British and French versions of the article on the Rosetta Stone.
For example.
Yeah. With respect to physicality in intellectual technology in general, do you see third-order organization as a supplement for all traditional knowledge systems, or as the eventual doom of physically embodied information? In other words, do you think there's a future for the book as a thing, and the library and the academy itself as physical places, or will we eventually see these technologies and institutions for creating, preserving, and transmitting knowledge replaced over wholly distributed networks of electronic media? Big question, I know, but on everybody's mind, but especially people who work in the academy. But.
They're separable. Of course, I don't know, but I think that we're going to continue to find value in face-to-face meetings. So the academy as a physical place seems to me to not be threatened. Libraries, as book-focused, as archives of physical books, we'll always have them in the same way that we have legitimate theater, but it's relatively unimportant in the entertainment mix of most citizens.
Yeah.
I think there are other roles for libraries and housing, warehouses. Housing books is just not going to be one of them.
Yeah.
I also think that we will lose our romantic attachment to physical books, which I share, in about as much time as we lost our romantic attachment to vinyl and then CDs. You know, we don't have anything close to the replacement technology for books.
For
Kindle
books at this
is not
point.
Yet.
No, it's,
you know,
not,
it's getting there, but it's not yet. But we will at some point.
Well, certainly for a student to have something that was interactive to some extent, where where you could link as you were reading, where you could take notes.
You ever try reading a newspaper on a subway? It's not just students. The paper sort of sucks.
Another question that kept coming to mind as I was reading your book, you make the point that knowledge no longer exists in the knower, but it exists between knowers. And certainly intellectual technology of any kind is about offloading cognitive labor into this technology. So, the question I keep returning to as I read your book is there any place for the cultivation of memory and the organizing of the self in the world of the third order? And I should say also, this question comes from a prejudice that derives from my background as a medievalist, which was a time when books were regarded basically as prosthetic advices for training the memory, and the training of the memory was thought to cultivate virtue and reason. So that from a medieval perspective, if knowledge isn't useful for shaping the soul essentially in some beneficial way, then it isn't of any use at all. And I'm thinking here also, I suppose, of Aristotle's notion of study, which in his definition is the contemplation of a thing in all its parts. So the question, I guess, might be, is study possible if the division of these parts is miscellaneous?
Oh, geez.
Big question. A big question, but, it's the question of physicality and the question of the self in this, I suppose. There is this anxiety about the fact that the self isn't, it isn't involved in a studious, contemplative way.
Hi. Okay, it's a great question. It's always been the case that knowledge has been social. We just haven't recognized it officially, so to speak.
Yeah.
That is, the Western tradition is dominated by, intellectual tradition is dominated by particular figures who were very lonely, and most of them were virgins, by the way, the line of philosophers. Descartes is maybe really put the last nail in our coffin here by thinking that the way forward was for him to sit in a small overheated room by himself and think. And so while we've always known personally and experientially that knowledge is developed through conversation with others, we try out ideas, we kick them around, we occasionally don't change our mind very often, but we get shaped. Our ideas get shaped by this interaction with others. Our metaphysics has said, on the contrary, that knowledge is something that's in our own individual heads, which is a sort of psychotic, schizophrenic idea. So our theory has been belied by our experience. It's hard even to maintain that theory because we have places like Wikipedia where the article, the truth that emerges in the article comes from explicitly from the conversation, and we're all used to mailing lists where even if there's an incredibly smart person on the mailing list itself is smarter than that individual. It has more value than listening to that individual by herself. We all know, we all see it all the time now, that knowledge is something that emerges between us and thus cannot be that which is in anybody's head alone. So our metaphysics and our experience are coming together. However, the notion of study is, I think, also knocked about by the third order, by the digitizing of everything, because the digitizing of everything also enables the connectivity of everything. And so our notion of knowledge ever since the printing press, which is obviously post-medieval, has been dominated by the image of the book.
Yeah.
The book is the externalization.
It's a container of knowledge.
It's a container, it's great at doing a certain type of knowledge containment, but the lesson of blogs and the web is that knowledge and book people who look at the web are in despair because it's all short bursts. What they're missing is short bursts that are contextualized and linked to by other people. And it's in that weaving, the very messy weaving together, that knowledge now exists. And that's what is really going to kill the book.
Yeah, see, the excitement of this all for me is that you get rid of this idea of the book as a container and go back to a medieval view where the human being is a container and the book is just a prop. But
And yes, but it's not simply the human as the container at this point. It's the it's the linking between us and between the pieces, which makes them explosive, incapable of ever being fully studied. You know, that sense of mastery is no longer possible because every time we come to the next masterful explanation of the topic we're discovering, it penetrated by links, literally without end.
Yeah, interesting. So the individual, you know, the monk studying in his or her cell just isn't a good image anymore then for the acquisition of knowledge. Even though we're all sitting and staring at computer screens.
But the computer screens generally are portals to other people.
So I
know enough experts, I mean genuine scholars and experts. I've met them in my life, not to dismiss them easily. I mean, they contribute mightily to our culture. There's no doubt in my mind about that at all. But we have that plus the rest. And the rest is the market of ideas.
So you don't see expertise or talent then suffering from this? I don't, I have to say personally. I see it being augmented, actually.
And I was in philosophy departments, and I'm sorry to say this, but some higher than usual percentage of philosophers, of academic philosophers, have a type of personality that is not very social.
Yeah.
Some of them are quite socially awkward, or even some, in some cases, are stunted socially.
Yeah.
And we benefit from them.
Librarians have this reputation also. Sometimes, often undeservedly.
In my experience, far less deservedly than some other types of scholars.
Yeah.
So we get the benefit from that, but we also get to take up their work now in a way that we couldn't have before. So we're able to magnify and multiply, and they are no longer the sole image of what it means to be a thinker or an intellectual.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank you, David, for visiting with us today and sharing your thoughts about organization and your book, Everything is Miscellaneous, The Power of the New Digital Disorder.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was really great to talk, and it was very, very interesting. I have to say, personally, I found the book very illuminating and helpful, that's for certain.
Well, it's great to hear.